Next hour, I'm going to ask you via Fast Blast to just give me your opinions on intelligent design as well, yes or no, but don't do that yet. We'll get to that in just a moment. With our three guests, Stan Tenen, Richard C. Hoagland, and Michael Heiser, we'll be back in a moment with all three of them on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Those of you joining us now from your respective election coverage in whatever city you may be in, good to have you with us. We are talking about intelligent design tonight with Richard C. Hoagland, Michael Heiser, and Stan Tenen. And Stan, you are going to give us the reading there and interpret it for us a bit.
Actually, this sums up a number of things I've been wanting to respond to, but have been waiting to respond to. Michael asked about whether it was a matter of playing dice, whether it was random. The answer is no, it's a matter of choice. And it's the first letter of the Hebrew Bible that establishes that choice. The letter Beit, meaning house, distinguishes between inside and outside, between mind and world. It represents all possible choices. That's the mark of distinction that George Spencer Brown, the topologist, uses to generate all systems, including living systems. In any event, I'm not the one who's saying that this is geometry-based. When I read you this translation, what you're going to see is that, in fact, it's the Hebrew Bible itself that starts off with geometry. There are 900 translations, according to the rabbis, for the first verse alone, depending on how you parse the letters and how you vowelize the text. But what I'm going to do is just read the raw meaning of the names of the letters. And here it goes. And if it sounds like physics, don't be surprised. It goes like this.
All right.
These are the words, in the beginning God created. The primary distinction between inside and outside initiates everything by expressing a single choice and all of its internal and external reflections. The primary distinction between breathing out and breathing in frames a single choice among the plenum of all choices. That's what the sequence of 14 letters at the beginning of the text says.
I don't know why you're opposed to intelligent design then.
Because there's a difference between intelligence and information. What's being established here is an information gradient, not an intelligence.
Not if there's choices
chooser.
Being made.
Hmm?
Choice requires deliberation.
No.
You know, some consideration of possibilities and consequences.
Well, actually,
you can't have a random, unintelligent process make a choice.
Well, I'm basing my understanding of what you asked on the work of Arthur M. Young, who wrote a wonderful book called The Reflexive Universe. Arthur was a topologist and mathematician. He's the guy that invented the parts of the helicopter that Sikorsky didn't invent. And many of my lecture tapes and videos were done at Arthur's Institute for the Study of Consciousness.
How is a choice made?
The quantum of conscious choice with the quantum of action with the photon. It's basically.
Then he should come up with another word, because how can you make a choice without thinking, without deliberation?
Well, you can't, and I can't. But in fact, every time a photon comes into existence.
So photons think.
No. Every time, I shouldn't even say a photon. Every time a subatomic particle comes into existence spontaneously, you can only tell probabilistically, approximately, when it's going to occur. You can never tell exactly. And not only that, but very often you can't tell what direction it comes off in. What Arthur Young points out is that this indeterminacy in direction, in the way, in what something is pointing to, from the external perspective, is analogous to the fact that I can't tell what's in your mind until you make a choice. So externally, it looks like a photon is making a conscious choice, even though in fact it's not. It's simply the quanta of choice.
So how do we know what looks like a choice isn't a choice? In other words, how do we know what looks like needs deliberation doesn't have deliberation? I don't believe in the
principle
in
science is
you don't
presume something that you don't have to. Occam's razor says always pick the simplest explanation with the least complications. So we should introduce choice when we have no other choice.
I don't think what you're offering is a simple explanation at all.
Hmm?
You haven't answered the question. How do we know what appears to require deliberation doesn't?
We don't. You can't tell externally.
So then we're back to my original question. You can't tell externally
if I've been thinking or if I just had a stroke. Can you?
Right, but a non. I mean, I don't know how I can say it any other way, other than to say pick a better term. I mean, because if you're going to say a choice is made, or even the appearance of a choice, and you're going to allow that the appearance of a choice might actually be a choice, then choice requires deliberation. This is one of the things that intelligent design opposes. Intelligent design doesn't really oppose evolution.
No, it does. If anything, it may accent it.
Right. What intelligent design opposes are things like, you know, like we're talking about here, that, you know, evolution assigns these qualities. It attributes intelligence or the power of choice to a fundamentally irrational process, namely natural selection.
You're confusing information, intelligence, choice, and distinction. It's not all just word stew where these words are interchangeable.
No, I'm asking for clarity.
All right.
Because I think these are very legitimate questions. And if the word choice isn't a good word, well then, you know, let's pick another one and maybe we can do the idea that I understand it
is that before the universe exists, there is, from the physics point of view, some sort of unknown space which is presumed to be indistinguishable, undistinguished, have no internal qualities that we can know. It turns out that from what I've been led to understand about the beginning of creation from a Abrahamic perspective, you start with something called Ein Sof, an infinite, endless nothingness. Now, I as a topologist, as far as I'm concerned, I don't see much difference between quantum vacuum or false vacuum or Ein Sof. Then I know that what I just read you from Genesis actually makes sense, because I know if you start out, no matter what you call it God, no matter what quality you want it to have, it doesn't have any distinctions to start. It's uniform, it's homogeneous, it's isotropic. The only first distinction that can happen is a smoke ring, because a smoke ring is the no thing falling through itself. It needs no other thing to refer to.
You mean a vortex?
Well, not a vortex, a smoke ring. A vortex is only half of it. It's got to blow out and blow in. It's got to come full circle. It's got to make a monad, a quanta of something.
Yeah, but you still need matter for this.
No, you don't.
Well,
no,
if you're talking
you can
about
do this
quanta,
conceptually. You,
need you
don't need matter for this.
Well, then we shouldn't be talking about quanta.
Mike, you need a plenum. You need an ether. You need a matrix to differentiate.
You need a conceptual space.
Well, I know there's a difference between what the physicists call nothing and the philosophical nothing. Okay.
Yeah, the physicist nothing is full of energy and all kinds of activity.
Right. Right. There is no nothing. So everything has to come from something.
Well, let's go back to the Big Bang for a moment, and maybe if I can get your take on all three
Mr.
of you.
Mr. Norrie right has put his finger on the problem.
I'm saying the Big Bang is that first letter bait at the beginning of the Hebrew text of Genesis that makes the distinction between mind and world. In fact, it sets the archetype of all possible distinctions. And that's what the mathematician Spencer Brown means by his mark of distinction, which he can show generates all of formal logic, and which he claims generates all living systems, but he obviously doesn't show that.
Well, Richard, jump in with my thoughts. You know where I'm heading here on the Big Bang, because...
Yeah, he's reading my mind.
As far as I'm concerned, you know, you wake up every morning, all of us do on this planet, trying to figure out who are we, what are we, trying to get through our day's events. And when you stop for 1 second to try to figure out just what the heck all of this is, we can't come up with an answer. And as far as I'm concerned, that alone should tell us there's some kind of design somewhere.
Well, it may be our assumptions, as Stan said, you know, in the last hour, may be wrong. In answering your question, let me go back to Francis Crick. Because about a decade after he and Dyson did this paper in Icarus, which basically blew a lot of minds when they, because they basically said, two world-class guys, you know, evolution ain't cutting it. Something else has to explain why we are here, but it ain't evolution. And believe me, the shockwaves that went through the scientific community, a Nobel laureate and someone of the stature of Freeman Dyson saying this together in the most prestigious planetary journal that was created, it was big, big news in the scientific community. In fact, I almost think, Mike, that that was the beginning of the whole intelligent design movement, that it kind of got its scientific sea legs then, because it could legitimately look to science itself as not having the ultimate answer.
But, Richard, there is nothing in science that enables you to prove a negative.
You can't
figure it out, therefore
quote,
it must be. That's what the magicians depend on.
Let me quote you what Crick said in a book that he wrote in 1981 called Life Itself. He said, and I quote, "An honest man armed with all the knowledge available to us now," remember this was 1981, "could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to have been satisfied to get it going." Now, obviously, I can't quote the whole book, but the unstated assumption...
Isn't that analogous to what was said about Penrose tiles before they were discovered to really exist?
Stan, take a deep breath. Hang on. What Crick did not say in that paragraph, because we don't have time, is within the limits of the time, George, of the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
When Mike and I and Paul Nelson and Hugh Ross, at the University of Wisconsin a couple of years ago, one of the interesting things that Hugh Ross did was to lay out from his astronomical perspective, because he is both a minister as well as an astronomer, all of the conditions, all of the numbers, and he loves to quote huge numbers like, you know, 10 to the 200th power and against the accidental arrival of life on Earth. And the bottom line for Hugh is that there isn't enough time. The bottom line for Francis Crick and Freeman Dyson, there isn't enough time. What the evolutionary people have been forced to do, because the astronomers and the cosmologists have basically said this is what the science says, is that all of these imponderable random things that create us tonight, talking about this on the radio, have to be shoehorned into 13 billion years and change. But what if that assumption is absolutely wrong? What if the Big Bang is an illusion, an elegant illusion of our instruments, our models, our theories, as Tom Van Flandern has argued so persuasively on the show many times before? What if, in fact, the universes is not only multidimensional, but is infinite in time? Then, of course, you got all the time in the world.
Is a model.
What was that? What was that great song? All the world in time. If that's true, then various parts of the universe may not have enough time in 4 billion, 6 billion, 12 billion. To create the complexity which represents us tonight, but another part could have, because it was infinite, and then if you transfer that complexity to another part of an infinite universe, you've solved Crick's problem, you've solved Stan's problem, you've solved my problem.
How come none of you has brought up the word faith in this discussion tonight? Nobody has.
Well, because I'm mainly a scientist, and I don't believe in faith. I believe in numbers.
I'm a religious person, and I don't think faith is my way of approaching.
I demand
experience and logic. I refuse to leave my brains at the door. And I do have faith, but in the things that I've experienced and the things I understand. I don't have faith in magic. I have faith that when David Blaine levitates on a city street, it's a trick.
It's a trick. And you, Mike Heiser, is there any faith there?
Well, I think faith is... I mean, I can only speak for myself here. I don't look at faith and reason as separable things, because all that means is then you have an irrational faith, which is kind of silly. Not to say that lots of people don't have that. But, you know, faith for me is when you come up against, you know, just things that,
Well, do you have to have proof to believe that there's a creator?
No, I think you have scaled possibilities. You know, some things more plausible than others. And, you know, Richard says he doesn't have faith, but, you know, I think everybody has faith in the sense that, you know, you're going to scale your possibilities between the plausible and the least plausible, and you're going to have a gut, you know, intuition that, hey, if, you know, given more facts and given more this or that, this is probably what it's going to be, and you're going to believe in that trajectory until, you know, you have to, you know, go another direction. So, you know, I think, you know, to me that's part of what faith is. I mean, there is a part that transcends matter and all that is. And if you believe that, you know, that there is an ultimate cause, then there are things that are put into that realm that you do have to just, you know, I'll use another word, trust, you know, in this reality that we can't, you know, put under the microscope. So I think there's a place for faith, but I don't equate it with the absence of reason.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I hope these 300 local school boards in Kansas do what we're doing tonight, and that's merely sit down with these kids and talk about the possibilities, because they'll learn more in these discussions than they would ever have learned listening to just one side of it.
Yeah,
What would be really cool is if someone in Kansas listening to us tonight were to take a tape or a DVD of this program and simply have teachers play it in biology class.
I think there's something missing that we haven't discussed yet that is more important for the Kansas folks that pay attention
and
to
what
to
is
teach
that?
Kids.
What is that?
And that is how you tell the difference between science and pseudoscience, that the real problem here is people are not aware of the boundaries. We are mixing up categories. It's not that one is right and the other is wrong. It's that apples and oranges are different things. That, in fact, when people say they're doing science, most people are thinking what a scientist would call scientism. They're believing in science instead of performing science. And many people mistake pseudoscience for science. The way science occurs in the movies is not the way science occurs in the laboratory. And the way science is conducted and judged is not the way it occurs in the popular media. And until school kids and school boards learn to distinguish what is scientific from what isn't, they're not going to be able to have an intelligent discussion about intelligent design.
An agnostic would say, look, it's not that I don't believe, it's just that I don't have any proof yet. An agnostic, of course, doesn't believe at all.
Well, is that faith? Because the scientist who would say, well, the answer to the problems of complexity is not an intelligent design creator, that the random processes of evolution that we've all sort of been weaned on will eventually someday produce the answers. Is that faith?
But why does it have to be random?
Well, I don't think it is, but I'm just saying when they say that, when those who take that position say, I believe that someday my view will win out, that we will have answers according to this paradigm.
Uninformed opinions are opinions based on faith. Based on information.
I don't think we'll ever get the answer, honestly. I think we'll individually get the answer when we die. We'll either move on to that other plane, or there'll be nothing.
George, I beg to differ. I think we are very close to laboratory demonstrations of the kind of physics that can allow for the spontaneous appearance of incredible complexity in biological systems.
Yeah, but you're talking science, Richard.
Yeah, of course I'm talking science.
I'm talking faith. I'm talking the ability to reason whether there's good and evil, whether there's a God or a devil. I don't think, though we can believe it, I don't think we'll ever be able to prove it. Do you?
Well, proving that there's evil is kind of like proving that, you know, the number of angels that dance on the head of a pin is infinite. It is definitely a matter of faith. You look at the world and you look at all the incredible, you know, travesties of human kindness, the absence of love, the presence of hate, the presence of segregation, the presence of group against group. And yeah, you can say that evil exists in the abstract.
We'll be back in a moment. Well, at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines. You and our three guests, you may ask one a question or just throw it into the panel and I'll just pick someone to answer it, but that's what we'll do. But when we come right back, we'll continue with a roundtable discussion with Stan Tenen, Michael Heiser, Richard C. Hoagland. Also at the top of the hour, I'm going to ask you to do a fast blast poll. I'll tell you about that in about 30 minutes on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with Michael Heiser, Stan Tenen, and Richard C. Hoagland. All of them have their own respective websites that are linked up to their names at coasttocoastam.com. Very simple to get to see what they do and kind of a series of works that they do. Richard, they all put in, including you, a lot of time following the issues that are so dear to your hearts.
You know, I want to say something in Stan's defense, and I don't want to put him on the defensive by saying this, but I've known Stan for almost as long as I've been involved in this whole looking at potential artifacts all over the solar system. Mm-hmm. We met at SRI back in the 1980s through a physicist who was a very religious physicist, it turned out, Lambert Dolphin. In fact, Mike, you may know of Lambert Dolphin's work.
Yeah, I'm familiar with his website.
Well, Lambert brought Stan in while he was also discussing, you know, we did our first Mars investigation of the artifacts at SRI per one of the vice presidents of Stanford Research Institute.
Right.
And it was in Lambert's office that I met Stan. And I remember thinking at the time, why in the world is he messing with this guy? What could this guy, Tenen, possibly have that could be important? 20 years later, I can tell you that that meeting with Stan in Lambert's office was perhaps one of the most pivotal and important meetings of my entire life. Because the geometry that Stan is trying to describe in words is very difficult to describe in words. You really need to see the pictures. And what I saw in subsequent years, particularly at Arthur Young's Institute there in Berkeley, where I lived, over a series of, what was it, like 5 or 6 years, Stan?
Almost 10 years.
Almost 10. You gave a series of lectures and presentations, which were taped and have now been transferred to DVD. I actually showed part of one at the United Nations back in the 90s when I did my back-to-back presentations there at the UN in 1992. Mm-hmm. You really need everyone out there who is trying to figure out, trying to conceptualize, trying to imagine in your mind on radio what Stan is talking about, you need to have, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. And the way you get that is if you're computer literate, you go to his website, which is linked both at Enterprise. We have a little box at the top tonight with Stan's special intelligence design page prepared and linked there. Or you can go to the Coast website where Alex has linked the main Meru page. And you can find his DVD sets. He's organized them in basically ascending order, from the simplest ideas to the more complex ideas to the development of the hand models and this geometry of space and time. And I got to tell you, it is the most remarkable conceptual decoding of the most sacred text from a letter geometry perspective. The Bible code notwithstanding, this has nothing to do with the Bible code. This is the real code underlying, in terms of Stan's work, the Bible that we have all grown up with in its original Hebraic form that you will ever, ever encounter. And it's going to take some work. It's going to take some intellectual, you know, elbow grease to kind of get your mind around this. And I'm saying this to my friend Mike as well, because remember you and I on the way to Roswell years ago talked about mm-hmm. me introducing you to Stan
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
his work? You can't get this stuff in one evening of a couple of hours.
I have a question for Stan on.
Well, can I get to my punchline?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, and I get to say thank you.
there are actually two punchlines. One is, if you're computer literate, you go to the website and all the stuff is there. If you're not computer literate, if you're basically sitting at home, listening to the radio, but you got a VCR or a DVD player, there's a number to call here, to get Stan's material, and you got to have the materials, and he's packaged it up in sets so that you can get what he's talking about, because it's incredibly important, as I'm about to tell you. So here's the number, 1-781-784-3462. 1-781-784-3462. And if you do have a computer, you go to the web and it's all taken care of. Now, here's the punchline. The stunning thing I found was Stan's geometry, this incredible complex geometry coded in the most ancient sacred text of the Western world, is all over Mars. Whoever left the stuff on Mars left the identical same geometry. And for me, that was this aha moment when I realized that, A, the stuff on Mars was real, because how could random stuff produce geometry? And not only was it real, but it was trying to tell us something profound. And the most profound thing you can tell another culture, another species, another extraterrestrial civilization across time and space, is how they got where they are, how they come to exist. So having said that, if you study Stan's work, you'll find it is the foundation of the hyperdimensional physics model of our work, prescinding from our Mars inquiries, and it all comes together in this program tonight about why are we here and why are we having this conversation.
Yet you're both still at a crossroads with intelligent design.
Stan?
Well, thanks, Richard. I really appreciate the strong, positive evaluation. Can I say something that maybe isn't so technical? And not everyone knows this, and I don't want to go into details. When you stick your neck out like I have and like Richard has, sometimes people take advantage, and we've been plagued by crazy people on the internet. I mean, clinically crazy people. And push came to shove, and one of the few people who could have made a difference, who was willing to stand up and make a difference, was Richard, and to do it when it made a difference, to do it when it counted. And that took a lot of integrity, and it took a lot of courage. And that's very unusual. So I don't always agree with Richard, and we don't even study the same things that much. But I respect what he says, because I've seen him in action when it made a difference. And the bottom line for me in all of this geometry and all of this religious material is integrity. I tell people that all of this living geometry that I'm working with is a model of integrity, because, in fact, integrity is one of the names of God.
Well, that's well said, Stan. Of course, all of it means, because Richard believes he's the intelligent design. Only Richard would understand that.
Well, an infinite God can make more than one intelligent design, but we each have a different specialty.
You know, is it possible that by the time we're off the air tonight, that we could come to some agreement that the bottom line is we just don't know? Is that possible?
I think we know more than we've discussed, though.
Yeah, but I mean, is it possible that we can honestly say, we don't know how it started? We don't know what made it.
Well, actually, the Talmud says that if a person speculates on what happened before creation, it would be better if they weren't born.
Well, I'm not going to speculate before creation. I'm trying to speculate on how creation started.
Well, I mean, that's what they're saying, that that initial point, the elusive mystery before the mystery, you keep pushing back the horizon. But if you keep doing that, it would be better you weren't born, because you're not respecting your creator.
You know, my mother always said, George, it always was, it always will be. That's the answer. And I kept saying, Mom, I can't figure that out.
But, you know, Newton said he couldn't figure it out either, but he was good at making models. He couldn't explain it, but he could describe it. And that's basically what science can do. And the methods of science lead to scientific descriptions, which are objective and which people can hold in common, whereas the methods that are outside of science tend to be more localized and who you can use
them
with.
Explain this for us, Stan, because as Richard said, it is complicated, your portion of it, on the radio without seeing it. But when you talk about geometry and what this means and the interpretation of it, what is this that you're talking about? Why is the geometry so important to the equation?
Well, I said it really, really quickly because I was trying to squeeze everything into one breath. But basically, we all know this, even though we don't notice it. Everyone knows that if you have a flute and you can play the flute, the tones, the repertoire of tones and sounds it can make are pretty much determined by the size and shape of the flute. It's a basic principle that the boundary conditions determine what's going on inside. It's even discovered recently in physics that the information inside the volume of a black hole has to appear on the surface of the black hole. At least that's one of the theories that's being put forward. That's the basic idea, is that there's an inside and an outside. And on the outside, in the Bible tradition, you have all the stories. They function as a vessel. And on the inside, you have the light, the science, the DNA, if you will. And it's the cooperation between these poles that keeps the system alive. Organic systems have... Well, look, actually, there's a definition of a living system. I'm getting a little far from your question, but let me finish this. John von Neumann, the great mathematician that invented information theory, all right, this is the guy that told us what information is, he laid out the conditions for a living system. And the crucial condition was, he said, a living system has to have a part of itself that is both a description of itself and a working model of itself. Now, it seems to me that is this inside-outside thing again. And that's exactly the qualities that we found at the beginning of the Hebrew text of Genesis at the letter level. It's a description of the logic of a smoke ring forming in the no thing. Whatever it is that existed before anything existed, it was no thing. So we're calling it a no thing. And the only thing that can form is this smoke ring. Well, not only is that what the letter text describes and the rabbinic literature repeats and modern physics demonstrates, it's in the Annenberg physics program for physics teachers, but it's also what happens when you take the Hebrew letter text of Genesis, write the letters out, one each on a bead chain, and curl the bead chain so the same letters line up, just like you're a kid making a paper model where you put tab A and slot A and tab B and slot B. The model folds up. The bead chain folds up into this same smoke ring. And this smoke ring that the first verse of Genesis creates as a working model is the same smoke ring it's describing. So it meets von Neumann's criteria for a living system. And the rabbinic tradition comes along and it says, the Torah is a tree of life for those who grasp it. I'm saying it's a logical tree, and it's a living thing because it has two components to it, acorn and the germ of the oak tree inside, as these two components. And it's for grasping because guess what? This smoke ring, which the text draws and describes, and the tradition describes, and the Talmud describes, and modern mathematicians describe, turns out to be made of six model hands. And when you put these hands, pair on your hands and make gestures, you see outlines of all the shapes of all the letters that the text is written in. And it turns out in physics, everything is based on pointing directions. And gestures carry natural meaning, and they're based on pointing directions. And this is enough intelligence. This is enough information to account for what Darwin didn't mention, and you don't need intelligent design.
Can I ask Stan a question?
Sure, go ahead, Michael.
Stan, it sounds to me like the shape of the letters is really important to your system. Is that right?
No, not per se. The fact that they are all different views of one shape that represents the unification of the names of God and this model of life. And this shape also represents an organic model of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which I call the Tree of Abraham. That, I mean, what there if, is one unifying model here representing the one God, if you will, and it's the same model as the physicists are using today.
I'm just wondering, okay, like the letter Beth, fate, depending on how you pronounce it, so that the shape of that is important?
The shape of that letter is what naturally, if you put this model hand that is drawn by the beginning verses of Genesis on your hand, and you make a gesture of being born, of distinguishing inside by outside, you bring your hands forward in a birthing gesture, you see in outline the exact shape of the Hebrew letter Bet.
Where did, I mean, I'll tell you where what I'm confused by is I'm not sure why you picked this alphabet.
Well, I'm still confused, gentlemen, what this has to do with the possibility of intelligent design or not.
Because intelligence is based on making choices, and choices are pointed out by pointing. And in physics, every entity is based on a pointing direction.
Richard?
A choice of a particle, if you will.
What if the letters are shaped differently?
You know, where this became very real for me, where we actually can bring these models together, is in the hyperdimensional physics perspective, because Stan's geometry, as I said a moment ago, was the beginning of my inquiring into whether there was a physics underlying the mainstream physics that we, in fact, accept today. Most people, most physicists are working with today. And that led me into historical perspectives going back 100 years to the work of people like Maxwell in Britain, who was the founder of modern electromagnetic science and technology, and other people who were geometry people, topology people. And it turned out that the physics that we have is really a co-opted physics that should be a multidimensional physics. Now, string theory is a kind of a distant cousin, but it isn't really what we're talking about. It's not on the main line of what I'm discussing. And where this all came down for me as a potential answer to the intelligent design question was when I realized that if you look at the history of the Earth, where we assume the Earth is about 5 billion years old, the solar system formed out of a nebula, formed planets 5 billion years ago, circling a star, the sun, et cetera, science, specifically biology and religion, has a huge problem, because it's like when you look back at the rocks, we find that life appeared on Earth, little microscopic guys, little one-cell blue-green algae type guys, which are very complex, almost as soon as the planet had cooled from accretion. We have evidence of life in the rocks going back literally almost 4 billion years. Now, that in the Francis Crick Freeman Dyson scenario is impossible. That's what they looked at back in 73 and said, this just can't happen. There wasn't enough time for all those random things to put together the soup out of which cells and little, you know, single-celled algae could possibly have originated. So they threw up their hands and they said, okay, somebody must have brought it here from someplace else. That, of course, does not answer the ultimate question because, as you said, George, early in the show, at some point in the universe, creation of life had to have occurred by its lonesome or by an act of God. Right?
Absolutely. Well, Richard, you know, as we come up to the top of the hour already, it's amazing how fast it goes. I mean, you look at everything in the universe, and everything seems to have a purpose. Everything we're stumbling across explains the reason why A leads to B, leads to C, and that just can't happen randomly. It just is impossible.
Arthur Young has a whole chapter on purpose. It's partially linked on through the website that we put up, and it deals with this idea of purpose and choice. And in fact, the gradient between singularity and wholeness is what Penrose says empowers the life of plants. It's what this Rabbi Schnur Zalman of Liadi said empowers the entire system in the same model. And it's a universal model that all you really need is a source of information, and then the system can make choices either consciously, like we do, or randomly,
we're gonna have,
mechanically.
We're going to have more questions with our three guests and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM in a moment.